Okay, perhaps I should explain who is organising this meeting. It's been organised by the Socialist Party of Great Britain, which we were founded in 1904 and have been known under that name, Socialist Party of Great Britain, but also under Socialist Party and SPGB ever since. Now, so don't get confused between another organisation which claims to be the Socialist Party, and if you think this is a debate between me, Peter Taff, and Andrew Kleinmuhl, this is, you know, this is not the case. We've nothing in common. They're Trotskyists. We're not. We're socialists, and they're not socialists. So, but no doubt, this argument that you've been having with these other people will come up in the course of this debate, because the title is Failure of Capitalist Production, Political Implications of the Great Recession. And the Great Recession, of course, is the crash of 2008 and the slump which followed, and the reasons, what caused it, and what can be done about it. So the speaker this afternoon is a guest speaker, is not a member of the Socialist Party, but is a writer on Marx and economics, for a collection of his pamphlets and books here, which we can look at afterwards. So we've invited him because on a number of issues, especially on this particular business of the Great Recession, we share a common position. But also on other things like the meaninglessness of a transitional society, and that socialism and communism mean the same thing. But last but not least, because we have the same view as to what the nature of a society that should replace capitalism should be. So I'll read a section here from this book. By a socialist economy, I mean a democratically run communal economy in which people's ability to work is not a commodity, and in which production and provision are oriented to the satisfaction of human beings' wants, not to the accumulation of ever greater amounts of wealth in the abstract or value. In order for economic activity to be reoriented in this manner, finance, money, exchange and value would have to be eliminated. So without further ado, I'll ask Andrew to speak on the failure of capitalist production and particularly the political implications of the Great Recession.
Thank you very much, Adam, and I thank very much the Socialist Party and Steve Clayton and everybody who helped to organize this. And I like speaking before a friendly audience, and I like speaking before a left audience. It's very rare that I get both of them together, but I have that opportunity here. Before I begin, I just want to note I've got some flyers here, these purple flyers, advertising a course on Volume 1 of Capital, Reading Capital Closely, that I'll be teaching by live stream, so it's available to anybody potentially throughout the world. I'll be teaching that in the upcoming school year, starting in September. So if you're interested or you know somebody who might, please take this. The live stream videos will never be made public, either during or after the course. So folks do need to apply. And the deadline for that is the 15th of this month. I was asked to speak about the political implications of the Great Recession. And I was also asked to speak about the underconsumptionist theory of crisis and why income redistribution won't be a solution, you know, to capitalism's problems at this juncture. I'm going to try to do a little of both. Let me just say a few things about the political implications of the Great Recession in general. I think this is really a momentous event. You know, the last large-scale major downturn in capitalism that lasted a long time was the Great Depression of the 1930s. And policymakers, up until the Great Recession happened, did not think it was ever going to happen again. They thought they had cured that problem. The excessive confidence that economic policymakers had in the 1960s, where they could, what they thought, fine-tune the economy, that era had passed. They realized that that was not the case. But they did not expect by any stretch of the imagination that something like this could happen. Okay, so the Great Recession has brought to light in a new way to a whole new generation or two generations or more the instability of capitalism. And I just want to quote something written by Lawrence Summers last year. Lawrence Summers is a very well-known mainstream economist as well as policymaker. He was Secretary of the Treasury of the U.S. Under Bill Clinton. And here's what he wrote just a year ago, less than a year ago. He writes, just 7 years ago, all seemed well in the field of macroeconomics. Business cycle volatility, that means the ups and downs in the economy, seemed way down from levels of the first part of the post-war period. But the economic crisis has led to a crisis in the field of macroeconomics. The idea that depressions were a concept of only historic interest has been belied by the global crisis and the Great Recession. In both the United States and the Eurozone, output production is far short of where its potential was expected to be as of 2008. Even more troubling is the observation that most of the gap is expected to represent a permanent loss. They're never going to grow back into it. For the Eurozone, GDP, gross domestic product, is almost 15% below its potential as estimated in 2008. Almost all work in both new classical and new Keynesian traditions within economics has presumed that with or without policy intervention, the workings of the market will eventually restore full employment and eliminate output gaps. So there's one side that says, leave it to the market. The other side says, well, you know, the government's got to intervene in the market. But in one way or the other, with or without policy intervention, they said, you know, the system is going to eventually restore full employment and eliminate output gaps. So Summers continues. The only questions they ask are about the volatility of output and employment around their normal levels. But what has happened in the last few years suggests that the more important issue to be concerned about is the average level of output and employment throughout time. Summers is suggesting that the average might not be normal for a pretty long time to come. He is a person who made what is now being called the secular stagnation hypothesis a real issue of discussion. Other mainstream economists, such as Paul Krugman, writes for the New York Times. Martin Wolf writes for the Financial Times. These are proponents of this secular stagnation hypothesis. And they're suggesting that, well, gee, you know, the financial crisis that led to, you know, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the collapse of Bear Stearns, et cetera, that financial crisis was basically resolved by the U.S. government by the end of 2008. The government came in with the bank bailout, TARP. They had stress tests, so-called, of the big banks. And the situation didn't quite return to normal, but there was no panic like there was in September and October by the end of 2008. Now, if this had only been a financial crisis, you know, or if, even if the whole Great Recession had just been triggered by a financial crisis, after this many years, you would expect the economy to have returned to normal. You know, if the cause is financial crisis, you no longer have a financial crisis, you would expect a return to normal. But we haven't had a return to normal, and it's now 8 years, almost. August of this year will be 8 years since there was a first, you know, real sign of a financial crisis. But the economy is not bouncing back anywhere, although the United Kingdom, the output growth is, in the last few years, is at a normal pace, and that's it's more, much more rapid. It's like double the rapidity of the German economy, for instance, and faster than the U.S. And I mean, France is still basically not in good shape. Slow growth there. I mean, Italy's in the dumps, and Most of the rest of the Eurozone hasn't even recovered to the level of output that it reached prior to the Great Recession. So there are these long-term problems, and secular stagnation, secular in economics means long-term, has nothing to do with not religious or anything. But what's very interesting about the secular stagnation hypothesis is people like Summers, people like Krugman say, it's not just now, they're not just predicting the future that we might have sluggishness for some time to come. They say that, but they say, why did the Great Recession happen? Why didn't the economy bounce back from the financial crisis? Why, even when we're no longer technically in a recession, do we have a really sluggish economy? They suggest that that state has been the default state of the economy for some time to come. In the same article I quoted from, Lawrence Summers notes that it's basically been two decades since the United States economy had normal growth without bubbles, on the one hand, or really easy money, exceptionally, you know, frothy, easy money monetary policy, you know, where after inflation, the interest rates are in negative territory, so that you you borrow and you pay back less once inflation is taken to account. And that's the situation in the middle of the last decade that the banks were in the United States. And the decade before that was the dot-com bubble. And so when you look at when they're growing, well, it's bubbles and it's, you know, just easy money floating around. And then you've got the Great Recession and sluggishness. So he's saying, well, it looks like there's been 20 years where the default state of the economy, without this bubbles and excessive money creation, we would have had stagnation. Paul Krugman dates the beginning of this to about the middle of the 1980s. I think this is a very big deal when some of the top economists, whose job is to make the system work, are saying that the system doesn't work. And they're saying that our theories that said the system works, they don't work. And we basically don't know what to do. I mean, among the things that Summers was saying is that the economics profession is in a profound crisis. Another, I think, extremely important political implication of the Great Recession that does not get talked about much on the left, it's kind of surprising to me, but I believe that the crisis of 2008 has made capitalism qualitatively more unstable than it was before. Okay, I think that there is a new problem that came to light, or has been created, or both, by the recession, well, the financial crisis of 07 and 08, and that's the problem of the financial institutions having become too big to fail. Policymakers do not want to bail out these financial institutions. They're actually bailing out the creditors, the people who, and other institutions that have lent them money. Just like, you know, in the Greek situation, it's the bailout that's going to benefit the creditors. You know, so they don't want these financial institutions to be bailed out. They would rather that they just be allowed to collapse. And I think that that was the motivation, really, for letting Lehman Brothers collapse in, I think that was September 15 of 2008. The reason that you don't want to bail out financial institutions is it creates what's known as moral hazard. It creates an expectation that, hell, you can engage in whatever kind of risky lending you want, you, the creditor of the financial institution. You don't have to look at the solvency and the way that the business does its operations, and their customers don't have to look at it either, because they know that at the end of the day, when all is said and done, if worst comes to worst, Big Daddy is there to make everything right. Okay, so that's a green light just to engage in whatever kind of risk you want. And when you gave, look, these people already engage in a lot of risk. then you give them a green light, engage in whatever risk you want. We're going to bail you out no matter what. And that's our policy, too big to fail. I mean, that's just like an advertisement, you know, for fraud, for all kinds of excess speculation and so forth. That's the situation that they got into, I think, now permanently post-Lehman. Because when Lehman was allowed to collapse, all hell broke loose. The world financial system was really hanging by a thread. It could have gone either way. If the U.S. House of Representatives at first rejected the TARP bank bailout, and then there was this miraculous do-over a week later, and you had the House Majority Leader and the House Minority Leader. Okay, you're in a safe district. You have to vote for TARP. Okay, well, you're in a close election. We'll let you vote against it. I mean, and they managed every vote that way, but with the understanding that this thing is going to be passed, because it's not just a matter of, you know, saving the institution. It's not even a matter of saving the creditors. It was a matter of saving the U.S. financial system and therefore the whole world financial system. So capitalism is qualitatively more unstable. The last crisis was the first time in which this too-big-to-fail doctrine was applied to institutions that were not commercial banks. You know, that's a technical distinction, but Lehman Brothers, for instance, was not a commercial bank. AIG, that the government did take over, is an insurance company, not a commercial bank. And the new policy is any systemically important institution, you know, is basically deemed too big to fail. So systemically important doesn't even have to be big in any sense of lots of assets or anything like that. But if it's tightly interconnected to the center of the financial system, the U.S. government has basically, without writing it down on paper, said, yeah, we know you guys are, you know, too big to fail. We're going to bail you out if all is said and done. And so, we don't know all the risks that they're taking, all the crazy behavior, but it was that way before. It's got to be that way much more since then. So it's not like they want it this way. They don't want it this way. But as the collapse of Lehman showed, they can't do it any other way. They have to institute this doctrine. So I'm not a big one for making predictions, but I would not expect the next crisis to be less severe than the one that we saw recently, the next big financial crisis. It would not surprise me that it was much more severe. And interestingly to me, that this is the opposite of the standard understanding of the trajectory of capitalism as understood by the Second International Marxists. For instance, you know, Karl Kautsky, Rudolf Hilferding, and so forth. They all kind of said, okay, once we get away from the anarchy of the market and towards state management and towards bigness and, you know, the concentration and centralization of capital, the instability caused by the anarchy of the market is going by the boards, and we're having planning and a managed economy, and it's becoming more stable. And I think events have shown that kind of reasoning leaves a lot to be desired. I also think that in terms of the political implications of the Great Recession, the kinds of things that I've been talking about have not been stressed on the left by and large. And I use the left as a descriptive political sociological term. It's not a term of approbation or anything like that. It's just, you know, who calls themselves the left? Instead of stressing, you know, capitalism is a crisis-ridden system, and we see this once again, and they're creating conditions that are going to make it even more unstable. What the left has been stressing from the beginning is issues of distribution. I mean, for instance, a few years ago, this was maybe 2011, Naomi Klein, a Canadian writer, says, well, America doesn't have an economic crisis. Okay, that's arguable. It has a distribution crisis. Right when the TARP bailout was being discussed, Howard Zinn, the late Howard Zinn, well-known Marxist historian, said, you know, we don't need this bank bailout. It's not going to help regular people. It's not going to end the recession. So instead of giving money to the big banks and bailing them out, what we should do is be giving money to teachers and cab drivers. I mean, he has a definite point that the TARP bailout wouldn't end the recession. But it wasn't about ending the recession. That wasn't the point at all. It was not a thing to get the level of economic activity up. It was meant to prevent a collapse of the financial system, entirely different thing. And it was just like, stick your head in the sand and do not recognize here, Howard Zinn, that we have a system in real crisis. And so you can't just apply a distributional formula to this money for this, not for that, money for this, not for that. I mean, that's a very standard formula on the left. Okay, they were basically caught unaware and not willing and not really able to grapple with the system in crisis. I even was at a conference, the first historical materialism conference in New York, maybe 2010, I don't remember, where a young guy gave a paper entitled, "There's No Such Thing as an Economic Crisis." Okay, there's a resistance on the left to grappling with this. His reasoning was, oh, well, you know, the reason you're calling this a crisis is because it's affecting white people. He was white himself. You know, what these so-called crisis conditions, these are normal in Detroit. And he's quite right. But that's what an economic crisis is. When the kinds of conditions that you have in Detroit become generalized, that's a pretty good operating definition of what an economic crisis is. Okay, and this distributional focus continues to be the focus of all left thinking. I mean, it was a big thing with the Occupy movement, of course, the 99% versus the 1%, and that continues. Why is this happening? Why the focus on distribution? Why not on the crisis-ridden nature of the capitalist system? Well, I think it's due to a lack of confidence in the working class, a lack of confidence in the possibility of a new human society or socialism, and that's become by far the most dominant trend in the wake of the collapse of the USSR. So you give up on a new society, you want to make things better, so you want to make this society better. So you want to try to make capitalism into something it's not, a system that works in the interest of the vast majority of people. You know, so you're trying to make something out of the system that it's not. And what this leads to is kind of like business unionism on the level of the whole society. You know, what do union bureaucrats do? They say, the company's rolling in profits. They're doing great. Could be true, sometimes it's not, but whatever it is, the company's doing great. They're rolling profits. They tell us this and that, but there's two sets of books. So the problem is not, you know, anything that the company is really facing. The problem is their greed. The problem is our members are not getting your fair share. So, you know, what we have to do is get you your fair share, and that's our role as the union bureaucrats. So you apply this to the society as a whole. Capitalism is doing great. They're rolling in profits, you know, for the decades preceding the Great Recession. The problem was not profitability. You know, it was just greed. They're rolling in dough. They're always rolling in dough. You know, they got cash hoards sitting in the banks, and the only problem is, you know, you're not getting your share. So if you think like this, you're just, like, destined not to face up to the real severe problems in the economy and to call attention of people that there's something wrong with a system that works like this, and let's be talking about a different kind of society where we don't have to endure this kind of thing. We don't get that. Let me say briefly what I do think. I'll just be brief about this, what I do think took place to lead to the Great Recession. Obviously, the financial crisis was the trigger, but I think that there were a lot of long-term underlying conditions building up for decades that made the system kind of weak and vulnerable. so that when you had a financial crisis, you know, you had a big slump and we haven't had a real big recovery. The rate of profit of U.S. corporations, I'm speaking about the U.S. principally because that's where the crisis broke out. So to understand it everywhere, you have to understand it where it broke out. The rate of profit of U.S. corporations, the rate of return on fixed capital investment, basically began to decline from the mid-1950s onward and did not rebound in any sustained way once Reagan came in and so-called neoliberalism came in. And profit is, of course, the basic source of funds for investment in machinery and equipment and software and so forth, the productive capital investment. So with a fall in the rate of profit, you get a fall, long-term fall, in the rate of accumulation, slower growth of productive investment. And, you know, that affects job growth as well. So we pretty much had decades of slower investment growth, and the productive investment is the main driver of economic growth, growth of output, GDP, and so forth. So we had decades of growth of GDP and so forth that was slower than it had been during the golden age of capitalism, so-called after the first few decades after World War II. And the slower economic growth leads to slower growth of income, and that led to a debt buildup. You know, your debts become more burdensome to pay when you have less growth of your income to cover the volume of debt. And then we had government policies, and I already kind of mentioned this, you know, easy money policy from the Federal Reserve, the central bank, all kinds of other policies that were meant to try to resolve, maybe reverse, manage this complex of problems, profitability, slower investment growth, and so forth. And these policies added to the debt problem. So they exacerbated the debt buildup in the long run, but they kicked the can down the road for a good deal of time. Then everything blew up, you know, but it was kind of waiting to happen, both the financial crisis, I think, and the Great Recession. Although there were very specific causes of the financial crisis, you know, like subprime lending, like policies of deregulation and so forth that are particular to why we had this big financial crisis. Now, I've also looked at why the rate of profit fell, and I concluded that Marx's theory of why the rate of profit falls fits the facts of the U.S. case pretty well. And I think that's important because Marx's theory of capitalist crisis is the only theory I'm aware of that puts the source of crisis squarely on the capitalist system itself. Every other theory of crisis I'm aware of says, you know, there's something particular here going on in this case, which potentially could be reversed, and everything would be fine. So there's theories in which, under consumptionism, the crisis is due to not enough consumer demand because of not high enough wages. So the solution, have high wages. Or you get the opposite theory. Well, the workers are getting too much, and that cuts into profit. Okay, profit squeeze theory. So how do you resolve the crisis? Well, put a squeeze on the workers, you know, smash the unions and so forth. Okay, so you do something particular to the system, everything is better, and so forth and so on. Theory after theory works like that. Marx's theory says it's inherent in the nature of value production that we get this fall in the rate of profit. Productivity increases, that's what the system is all about. That's, you know, however, the source of the fall in the rate of profit. Why? Well, the physical productivity goes up, but that causes the values of the commodities to fall, and that tends to put pressure on price growth as well. So I think that that's important. In a day and age where even the mainstream economists are saying, gee, there's something seriously wrong with the system here, I think it's important to take a second look at a theory that places the crisis tendencies inherent squarely on the nature of how capitalism functions and how it operates. Okay, I want to say something about, as I was asked to, why boosting wages and consumption would not be or won't be a solution to capitalism's economic problems. The short version, okay, you might get lost in the details that follow, but the short version is boosting wages and consumption, that's not going to be a solution to capitalism's economic problems because low wages and underconsumption are not the causes of its economic downturns, either in this case or in general. Okay, to justify that's going to take a bit of time. But the theory, the underconsumptionist theory of crisis, that the crisis or downturn slumps, it initially seems plausible to people for a few reasons, and I want to go through that. The first thing that people say is, well, you know, gee, it's not only production that matters, you know, production of surplus value. Once the products are produced that have this surplus value in them, they have to be sold or the capitalists don't get any profit. Absolutely correct. Sales matter. Demand matters. But the problem with the underconsumption theory is it tends to identify, or at least one version is it tends to identify demand, selling, with consumption, personal consumption. Okay? But demand can't be reduced to consumption because there's another portion of demand which is called investment demand. When companies spend to build factory buildings, to install equipment, to purchase software, all of that, that's called investment demand, and that's a portion of demand as well. And certainly, even the issue of personal consumption cannot be reduced to the issue of wages, because there's a whole other class there called the capitalists, and they get their incomes from dividends and interest and so forth. And, you know, they take a lot of that money and they also spend. Okay, and it's also said, gee, well, consumption really has to matter. It has to really be the key to the spending issue because by far it's the biggest part of the economy. Like in the United States, you take the gross domestic product, well, 70% of that or so is consumption spending, personal consumer spending. It's the biggest part. So it doesn't have to be the case that, you know, the crises are due to a lack of consumer spending. Well, no. It's 70%, but it's really stable. You know, when you have an economic crisis, people don't stop buying toothpaste and toilet paper, right? They keep doing that. What doesn't get spent on is new factory construction, installation of, you know, whole new big computer systems by businesses and so forth and so on. So I looked at the period from 1943 to 2007, 65 years in the United States. And during that 65-year period, there were only 2 years in which, after inflation, consumer spending fell. 1974, 1980. Okay. There were 20 years in which investment demand, productive investment demand, fell in the factory buildings, the equipment, and so forth. So 20 years versus 2 years. And the typical pattern of a downturn in the economy, whether it's big or small, is you get a drop in corporate profits. That leads to a drop in productive investment. That leads to a drop in employment. That leads then the drop in employment and all of that lead to drops in wage growth and consumption growth and occasionally even a decline in the level of absolute consumption, but that's very rare. Now, there's another basic intuition underlying the idea that a lack of consumption and especially low wages are the root of the crises. It's the observation that workers can't buy back the whole product, all of what they produce. Well, yeah, if they did, then we wouldn't have surplus value, we wouldn't have profit. You know, if they got wages that were equal to the whole product, there wouldn't be any profit. But this doesn't explain the crises of capitalism, the downturns, the slumps, because workers can never buy back the whole product. whether we have a slump or whether we have a boom or whether we have something in between. Okay, so this is like blaming an airplane crash on gravity. You know, when airplanes crash, there's gravity. When airplanes don't crash, though, there's also gravity. You know, so the gravity doesn't explain why, in some cases, rarely, the airplane crashes, and most of the time it doesn't. The fact that workers don't get to buy back all of the product doesn't explain why, you know, it was in 2008 that the economy turns down and not in 1963, for instance. Okay, so people's lack of power to consume doesn't account for the one case versus the other case. Something else, something specific, is needed to explain why we have these recessions. Okay, so once you understand that we don't only have consumption spending, but we have investment demand. That's a part of demand. Productive investment, equipment, factories, and all of that. When you think about it, the portion of the product that the workers can't buy back, that doesn't mean that there's got to be a lack of spending. First of all, the capital is consumed from their dividends, from their interest payments, and so forth. And then there's the demand that comes in from the investment spending. And those additional two components can fully offset, can fully make up for the gap between the value of the output, what's produced, and what the workers are able to buy. Now, that doesn't always happen, right? I mean, that's what the Great Recession was. It didn't happen in a big way. So let me give you a simple example, just a few numbers. Let's say the value of what's produced is 100, and 80 is what the workers can buy back and what the capitalists buy back through their personal consumption with their dividend and interest payments. Okay, so 80 is consumption that buys 80 out of that 100, and there's 20 remaining. Well, we're not going to necessarily have a downturn in the economy because stuff can't be bought back. If there's productive investment spending of 20, we got 80 and 20, that's 100. So production can continue at the same rate, employment can continue at the same rate. Sometimes, though, productive investment spending isn't going to be 20, it's only going to be 15. Then we have an output of 100 and spending of only 80 plus 15 or 95. Then we've got a problem. You know, that's already a 5% drop in production. That's already a serious recession. Okay. But that serious recession has nothing to do with the fact that the 80 is not equal to the 100, that the consumption spending doesn't buy back the whole product. If you have investment spending of 20, everything's fine. Okay. But the consumer spending is only 80. Okay, you have a recession, consumer spending is 80. So the consumer spending is 80, whatever is happening, and what you have to do is look at the investment spending being 20 versus being 15. That's a simplified version of what I think is the actual case. How am I doing on time?
Well, we've been for half an hour, so you've got another 10 minutes or so.
Okay. So this brings me to the sophisticated version of underconsumption theory. There are people who do understand that there is this investment demand and that it matters and that it's the fluctuations in investment demand that are really the key to the ups and downs. And they say, look, the underconsumptionist among them, okay, investment demand matters and investment demand can fill the gap between the whole product and what the workers and the capitalist consumption is able to buy. But they claim that investment demand cannot fill this gap indefinitely into the future. Why not? Because in the end, they say, the volume of productive investment demand, equipment, factories, and stuff, that is in the end limited by consumption demand. Well, why? Their reasoning is basically that they think of production as a one-way process, leading ultimately to consumption. So for instance, cattle are raised to produce leather, leather is tanned to produce shoes, and the shoes have to be bought by people. And steel is produced, and steel is used to build machines, and the machines are used to sew the leather on the soles of the shoes, but then again, you got the shoes, and they've got to be bought by people. So it all ends up with consumer demand. And so the lack of demand for consumer goods ultimately then, if that's the way production were, the demand for machines, the demand for the steel, the demand for the leather, the demand for the cattle, all of that would be limited by the demand for shoes. You're not going to, as a capitalist, invest in machinery, invest in big stocks of leather if you can't sell shoes, or the other capitalists are not going to be able to sell the shoes. So the demand for these investment goods would be strictly limited by consumer demand. But the problem is that picture of production as a one-way street is misleading because it's incomplete and so it's wrong. There's also circularity in production. Okay, let me divide production into three parts. There's production of consumer goods. That's limited by the demand for consumer goods. Okay, so production of shoes is limited by the demand for shoes. Then there's production of means of production, investment goods, that produce consumer goods. So leather, shoe stitching machines. Okay, so these are means of production that produce consumer goods. Demand for these means of production, the leather, the stitching machines, the demand for these things is limited by the demand for shoes. But there's a third part of production. This is the machines that produce machines, means of production that produce means of production, rather than means of production that produce consumer goods. And the demand for the machines that produce the machines, the means of production that produce the means of production, the demand for this part of the output is not limited by consumer demand. So it's a circularity. Means of production that produce means of production, it's governed by the demand for these means of production that produce these means of production. So I say machines that produce machines. I mean, that's a simple example. Slightly more complex one is you have iron, and the iron is used to produce steel, and the steel is used to produce digging machines, and the digging machines dig up iron, which is used to produce steel, which is used to produce the digging machines, which is used to dig up the iron, and that's a circular process. Okay, so the demand for iron is determined by the demand for steel, which is determined by the demand for the digging machines, but this is in part a self-contained process. So the capitalists are their own buyers and their own sellers in this case. Now, Marx's scheme of expanded reproduction in volume 2 of his book Capital is the first real description of this third part of production, the machines that produce the machines, and exactly how this third part relates to the other two parts. Marx's scheme shows that in principle, the third part of production can indefinitely offset any limits set by the lack of consumer demand. It's not tethered, it's not limited by consumer demand. That's what his numerical examples show. And they also show that the growth of the capitalist system, when it does grow, is through the relative expansion of this third part of production, the machines that produce the machines. So production of means of production, machines, grows faster than production of consumer goods, the shoes. And the way that this takes place is that a bigger share of the machines that are produced go into producing other machines, and a smaller share of the machines that are produced go into producing consumer goods. That's what the expanded reproduction implies. And people have known about this for a very long time, over 100 years, and the response of the under-consumptionists is basically to stick their heads in the sand. Rosa Luxemburg was very well aware of this process, but she says this is just absurd. It turns the capitalists into fanatics that produce for the sake of production rather than the sake of providing things for people. This is not production to meet human needs. This is production for the sake of production. Well, that's fanatical. That was Rosa Luxemburg's view. Paul Sweezy, the foremost under-consumptionist of the 20th century, basically reiterated that view and said, look, this is just not the way things are. Production is ultimately production for consumption, you know, not production for production, not machines that produce machines. And this other group that calls itself the Socialist Party, they have the exact same position. Peter Taff and Lynn Walsh wrote in their so-called reply to me, Hayek, an Austrian right-wing economist, Hayek, and now it seems Kleiman, argue that this can go on forever without limit, with a smaller and smaller proportion involved in the production of consumer goods. Kleiman states, they quote me, growth can occur indefinitely despite a relative decline in consumption demand by means of an increase in the demand for machines to produce new machines and a relative expansion of machine production, close quote. Then Taff and Walsh say, okay, the working class will never be able to buy the consumer goods the increased means of production generates, but the system goes on with increased means of production stretching out to infinity, accompanied by permanent impoverishment of the working class. These conclusions of Hayek are insane. A reductio ad absurdum of capitalism, and were recognized as such by Marxist economists at the time who answered him, Hayek. Okay, but it's not only Hayek who said this, it's what Marx's schemes of expanded reproduction imply, and, you know, this is everybody has known for a very long time on both sides of the argument, this is what the schemes of reproduction imply. But they just say, okay, look, it turns capitalists into fanatics, I don't believe it, so I'm going to reject it. But who said that capitalism can't be absurd? You know, who said that it has to be a system geared towards production for human consumption? It doesn't seem to be a system designed to meet human needs. So why should it be, in this case, one that ultimately ends up with, you know, more consumer goods and you're not going to get an expansion except insofar as it's needed to produce more consumer goods? And judging conclusions by whether you think they're absurd or not is not really a very reliable method of getting at the truth. Almost all of modern physics seems absurd to us. Okay? And there's reasons for that. We live in a very particular kind of part of reality, you know, middle-sized reality. So the very big and the very small work very different, and how they work just seems absurd to us because we're not familiar with it. Okay, but judging, you know, the truth of things by whether they conform to our intuitions is not good policy. Physics has made progress by weeding out this idea that conclusions have to fit comfortably with our intuitions. There was a recent movie about Stephen Hawking, and he says, you know, in physics, what you believe doesn't matter. I thought that was very profound. And I think we should take that to heart and learn from it. What you believe doesn't matter. Now, there is another version of a reply to this machines producing machine things coming from Baran and Sweezy in their book Monopoly Capital. They try to show that economic growth would have to be explosive, you know, faster and faster and faster growth if production of machines to produce more machines expanded indefinitely. The basic idea is, when you have increased investment demand, factory buildings, equipment, well, that gives you more production, okay? And that gives you then, with the more production, an even bigger gap between the product and the portion that the workers can buy. And the only way to fill that is with even a bigger volume of investment demand, but that exacerbates the problem because now you get even a bigger volume of production, even a bigger gap between the volume of production and what the workers can consume. And that can only be filled by a bigger dose of investment demand, and you get this ever-increasing growth rate faster and faster and faster and faster. 1%, 2%, 4%, 6%. To show the error here, it takes a bit of work. I can't demonstrate it in this talk, in my book that Adam has. I do show, you know, in detail what's wrong with it, but I can tell you what I think the crux of the error is. The rate of economic growth has to increase indefinitely if you get production of machines to produce more machines. That's expanding indefinitely. But the fact that something is increasing indefinitely does not mean it increases without limit. So you could have an increase in the rate of economic growth that's not like that, you know, astronomical. You could have like that. So it goes up forever, but what we call asymptotically, you know, 2%, 2.5%, 2.8%, 2.9%, 2.95%. Okay. And that seems quite reasonable to me. I mean, it seems very much in keeping with the actual trajectory of the world rate of economic growth over the last, let's say, 400 years. Okay. You had very little economic growth, and it's gradually been, the rate of economic growth has gradually been rising, but not astronomically. Okay, let me say just a few words about why, in particular, in this instance that we're living through right now, limited wages and limited consumption are not causes of the crisis, and why reversing that, you know, boosting wages and stuff isn't going to be a solution. If reversing income inequality were the solution, the Great Recession should have resolved itself, because the recession led to a massive narrowing of inequality according to the most popular measure. In the United States, between 2007 and 2009, the share of tax return income captured by the 1% fell by more than one-third. Everybody else, their share of income fell by 4%. Okay, so that represents a massive narrowing of income inequality. And if income inequality were really what the issue were, that should have resolved the problem. But it didn't. Okay. Also, over the period 1970 to 2007, the share of the product, the net output that the business sector produces in the United States, that corporations produce, the share that went to pay employees, employee compensation, that was flat. It did not decline. So the worker's share of the product did not decline. Didn't rise, but they got basically a stable share. Okay. Now, the pay of top execs, CEOs, you know, other top execs, that does get counted in the employee compensation figures. That could skew the numbers. So it could be like all the regular workers, their share is going down, 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 and the top execs are getting bigger, bigger, bigger share, and that keeps the total share constant. But that's not the case either. I looked carefully at this issue. The basic issue is that, yeah, the pay of the CEOs and the top execs skyrocketed, but there aren't that many top execs, and their presence can't push the numbers around that much. So that's not the source of the employees' share remaining constant. Okay. And actually, when you listen to the underconsumptionists and stuff, they admit that there was not a fall in consumption demand as a share of GDP prior to the Great Recession. But what they say is there would have been a fall in consumption demand if there hadn't been this big, massive increase in consumer borrowing. But there was this big, massive increase in consumer borrowing. Why? Because the worker share went down, and to keep up their consumption levels, their standard of living, workers had to borrow more, 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 more. That's not the case either. When you look at consumer credit, that's all borrowing by households except for home mortgages. Okay. Consumer credit was not a rising share of people's consumption. Okay, for decades. And for most of the period up till the mid-90s, even mortgage borrowing by households did not rise as a share of total consumption. Then you get the housing bubble, the home price bubble of the late 90s and the middle of the last decade. Okay, but it was not like this increasingly growing problem throughout neoliberalism. And you get this phenomenon also supposedly of people using their home equity, you know, the value of the homes that they own, borrowing against it, you know, so using their homes like cash points and fueling and funding their consumption that way. That didn't really begin to happen until the late late, very late 1990s either. You know, that all was associated with, there was a home price bubble and people were speculating. So people were borrowing and buying homes and hoping that the price would go up and they could sell it even higher. That's a phenomenon, though, that was like from the late 90s onward. There was not borrowing just to keep up consumption levels.
Wait, you speak for 55 minutes.
Yeah, okay. I have been going for 55?
Yeah.
Okay.
This could run out soon.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've been trying to not, like, rush. But let me just say, you know, since I'm talking about the political implications, I haven't specifically talked about the political implications of the underconsumption theory. So let me end with that. Sweezy, who I said was the foremost underconsumptionist of the 20th century, originally claimed that underconsumptionist theory was revolutionary, pointed to the need for a revolutionary change in the social order. But by 1995, he was arguing something quite different. He said, okay, what policy conclusions does his analysis point to? And in quote, he says, public ownership of the means of production and planning to meet the needs of all the people won't be a serious option anytime soon. The question should therefore be reformulated: what could be done within the framework of the private enterprise system to make it work better? Okay, so he mentions one thing, and then he says the second indispensable change to make the private enterprise economy work better is a redistribution of wealth and income toward greater equality. We live in a period in which an unprecedented and growing share of society's income accrues to corporations and wealthy rentiers, coupon clippers, while the share of the underlying population stagnates or declines. This implies a permanent imbalance between society's potential for adding to its stock of capital and its flagging consumer power, which is another way of saying, well, that was the underconsumption position I was putting forth before. So then he says, would the capitalist class as a whole and extremists be willing to give up half of what it has to save the other half of what it has? I have a feeling that the fate of the private enterprise system may depend on the answer to this question. So he's clearly coming forward as somebody trying to make the private enterprise system work better and saying, well, what the capitalist class needs to do to make it work better is to give up half of what it has, and then people will spend, and that will prop up the system. And I'm very worried about the political implications of this kind of thinking, because it implies that, gee, there's really a simple solution to getting out of the kind of mess we're in. We just need a more equitable distribution of income, and I just don't think that's the case. I'm not suggesting, I got to make clear, that working people should refrain from fighting for a bigger slice of the pie or for other reforms. Yeah, I mean, people need to, and they are fighting for concessions or at least measures to keep up their standard of living. And yes, I'm totally in favor of that. The point is there should be no illusions that by getting these concessions, we're putting capitalism on a stable growth path and, you know, making the system work good and in our interest at the same time. So the question is not reform or revolution. I'm all for reforms. The question is rather, is what's good for the working class good for capitalism? And I think that that's just not the case. I think that capitalism is a system of production for profit, and you get higher wages and you get higher benefits and you get these concessions that cuts into profit. You're siphoning off the fuel on which the system runs. So that doesn't make it work better. It makes it run worse. Does that mean I'm against it? By no means. Okay? I'm just saying we shouldn't be the ones to try to tell the capitalists how they should run the system. They have to run it in their own interests, which are not our interests or the interests of the vast majority of people. There is no way around this dilemma in a class-ridden society. The only way of getting a general good is to have a society without classes, and that's what I think we need to be fighting for.